actors entering the political arena do so depending on the price of their violence. So again, this process where kind of, you know, money and politics is kind of captured in a very kind of small and tight circle then dictates, you know, the price of who gets to be invited in and who gets to be excluded. As a result of this, you've got a lot of different actors who are becoming more violent and more on by the minute, and they're all fighting over the state as spoils.
This program is brought to you by Haymarket Books as part of our live event series. Haymarket Books is a radical, independent publisher dedicated to connecting social movements with the ideas they need in the struggle for a better world. You can help support the Haymarket Project by buying books at haymarketbooks.org and especially by joining the Haymarket Book Club. By joining the book club, you get all new Haymarket titles delivered to your door and a 50% discount on the entire Haymarket website, all for one low price. Be sure to subscribe to our podcast and the Haymarket YouTube channel to access all of our upcoming events. If you really want to help us out, rate and review the podcast on Apple or whatever platform you're listening on.
Welcome and thank you for joining us for today's webinar, Counter-Revolution in Sudan, Understanding the Causes of the Current War. The sponsors of today's important event are Haymarket Books and Spectre Journal. Spectre Journal is a Marxist journal and website that was launched in 2020 to cover issues of Marxist theory, internationalism, and oppression, including with a focus on revolution and counter-revolution in Sudan. We encourage everyone listening to become a subscriber and monthly donor. Spectre and Haymarket Books are proud to present this panel on the current crisis in Sudan. On April 15, just under 3 months ago, conflict between two military factions in Sudan broke out into armed warfare that has continued in spite of numerous failed ceasefire attempts. It directly affected the country, in particular the capital, Khartoum, with aerial bombardment and on-the-ground fighting, destroying homes and hospitals and displacing thousands. Before this outbreak of war, Sudan was in the midst of a revolution that began in December 2018. The mass countrywide revolution had toppled the dictator, Omar al-Bashir, and was still working to overthrow the military apparatus and replace it with a civilian government. The revolution has seen experimentation with different forms of revolutionary organizing and tactics, but is now forced to a near standstill with the current war. This webinar will discuss in depth how we got to this point today, the background to the conflict between the military factions, and prospects for the return to revolution. Now, it's my pleasure to introduce the speakers, Nisreen El-Amin, who will be moderating and acting as discussant, and Rajab Makawi and Hamid Khalifallah. Nisreen El-Amin is currently an assistant professor of anthropology and African studies at the University of Toronto. She's currently writing a book tentatively titled Stratified Enclosures, Land, Capital, and Empire Making in Central Sudan, and has written for Al Jazeera, The Washington Post, OK Africa, and The Egypt Independent. Rajab Makawi is a Sudanese editor and researcher currently based in the UK. And Hamid Khalifallah is a former non-resident fellow at TIMEP, focusing on inclusive governance and mobilizing in Sudan, and he is working as a program officer for the International Institute for Democracy and Electoral Assistance, supporting Sudan's democratic transition. So without further ado, Nisreen, feel free to take it away.
Thank you so much, Shireen, for that introduction. I also want to thank you and Duhaf and John and everybody else for organizing this event, and Haymarket and Spectre for co-sponsoring it. I'm really honored today to be moderating this conversation with two people who I've learned a lot from, whose analysis and writing I've really valued over the last couple of years. And so I guess we'll just jump right in. I'm eager also to get the audience's, get to the audience's questions, but we have some prepared that we're going to start with now. So the first question to both Raja and Hamid are, what are some of the root causes of the current war in Sudan? Some people might argue that we have to go back to the 19th century to really understand how we got here, but in the interest of time, perhaps you could each highlight some key moments or processes in the country's recent history that can help our audience better understand what is happening in Sudan today. And feel free to add one author or book you would recommend for people to read to better understand the situation in Sudan. So maybe we'll start with Raja.
Thank you, Nisreen. So as you said, Nisreen, that the long history of capitalism as a political system is a good place or a good framework to use to try and understand Sudan's, you know, compounding and ever deepening problems. But I would outline here the role of development as a problematic external force at odds with a conciliatory internal political project. So this adversity that has developed throughout Sudan's post-colonial history into a governance model. So basically how money that comes from outside and the political system that's run by elite has kind of developed into a self-entrenching governance model by violence. So the idea that money that's brought in from the outside in the name of development, aid, political financing, whatever it is, whatever category it falls under, acts as an incentive for political capital. And now this is done now through deals that have been legalized into political processes and governance models of state building and peacemaking. It's this power and wealth sharing formula which was once envisaged as a solution to jumpstart a redistributive process has in itself become a purpose for itself. So just, you know, elites pillaging money that's coming in from the outside for their own enrichment. Now, actors entering the political arena do so depending on the price of their violence. So again, this process where kind of, you know, money and politics is kind of captured in a very kind of small and tight circle then dictates, you know, the price of who gets to be invited in and who gets to be excluded. And as a result of this, you've got a lot of different actors who are becoming more violent and more armed by the minute, and they're all fighting over the state as spoils. And you kind of see this in, you know, the latest version of, you know, Sudan's crisis, which is this war turning into a civil war, that you've got two armed actors that have been kind of, you know, enabled by external funding, by external financing, and they've reached a level that they've both become, you know, equally capable or equally kind of armed or have equal control over the monopoly of violence, that each one wants to kind of, you know, push the other out with the aim of consolidating, you know, its own power over the state, and through the state they get access to more money. And so the cycle goes on and on. So what I was hoping to kind of infer from this maybe ambitious kind of introduction on my part is to kind of try and kind of, you know, prompt people reading about Sudan and just generally thinking about crises across Africa or just in the global south or in today's world to think about the connection between, you know, development discourse or development models and the failure of the state, politics, and institution at a domestic level, and how both these processes kind of, you know, shape and affect each other. So just to follow up very quickly with your second question about who to read in relation to the point that I've made, I mean, obviously, I would, you know, self-servingly recommend our own book, Sudan's Unfinished Democracy, The Promise and Betrayal of a People's Revolution, from Hearst Books. And this would serve those looking to understand Sudan's, you know, current current state or, you know, current affairs in Sudan. However, since the post-colonial history of Sudan is also important in understanding the context in which these events have developed, I would always recommend Jay O'Brien's Economy in Sudan for its historical materialism framing, particularly the role of merchant class or merchant capital in setting the scene for, you know, today's problematic governance model. The book is out of print, but it's definitely a gem worth kind of, you know, trying to locate and source and probably buy and keep. Finally, I would add Noah Salomon's exceptional text. It's an anthropological study of the relationship and continuities between a state-induced and managed Islamic political culture, and then the more recent political ideals and imaginaries that have developed in the aftermath of the revolution. Obviously, Noah's book stops short before the revolution happened. I mean, it's, I think, 16, 17, but it gives us that, you know, usually kind of missing narrative, that missing picture, larger picture of how people, their politics, their culture, the daily behavior, and their relationship to the state kind of feature in this process of democratization. I'm just going to stop here. Thank you.
Go ahead, Hamid, if you'd like to add something.
Thank you so much, Nasreen. Yeah, just a couple of points that I would like to add. I definitely echo everything that Rajat mentioned. And I think if when we think about, you know, the history or the root causes behind the ongoing conflict now, I think it's also important to think about the main warring factions who are involved in the conflict and where did they come from. And in that sense, I think it's also most of the kind of discussion now is about the paramilitary rapid support forces and how they were formed and so on. But I think not enough is being, you know, mentioned about the roots of the Sudanese armed forces and the particularly the colonial roots of the Sudanese armed forces and how it was, you know, established by colonizers as Quds Difa' Sudan or Sudan defense troops. And, you know, that legacy and that history continues to shape the way they operate until today. They have not, you know, been under any sort of reform. They have actually resisted as an institution any attempts to reform and so on to make them more professional and more inclusive and also more relevant to the Sudanese realities and so on. And because of that, they continue to get involved in politics, in the economy, orchestrate coups in partnership with political parties and so on. So consequently, we ended up with a corrupt military that is functioning very poorly, despite receiving an average of 70%, I think, of the budget every year for the past few decades. Yet, you know, we see how it's not functioning well, despite that kind of funding that has not been going into reforming the military as an institution that, you know, should be responsible for the manipulation of power in the country and so on. And obviously that is also not separate from, you know, the weakness of the state and its institutions in Sudan historically, in, you know, as a post-colonial state, and then all the history that it, you know, we went through ever since the independence and so on. And also this history of the military and the culture that they have of establishing militias to fight on their behalf is mainly how we ended up with having the paramilitary rapid support forces who were established by the military in the first place to fight on their behalf in Darfur and so on. And in more recent years, I think, you know, going from actors now to processes, the multiplicity of militaries in Sudan and particularly with the rapid support forces expanding and growing in size and having their own economy and all of that, has always been a ticking bomb. And grassroots movements like the resistance committees and Sudanese civil society have, who are currently actually bearing the heaviest burden of the ongoing conflict, have continued to advocate for the security sector reform and for the dissolution of the rapid support forces. But they were obviously ignored, as you can see. And the slow progress, or actually lack of progress on that file, has allowed this happen, this war to take place in the first place. Last point that I would mention is that, you know, the continuous legitimization of the warring generals now, both General Abdel Fattah al-Burhan and General Himeti, by the international community, by giving them, you know, not only seats, but, you know, primary seats at tables and allowing them to become part of Sudan's politics and so on, have legitimized them as political leaders, but it has also nurtured their political ambitions. And this is mainly what's pushing them to continue fighting today in the streets of Sudan. That's all what I would say for now about, you know, the root causes that caused the current ongoing fight. In terms of authors to read, you know, to understand better what's happening in Sudan, I would recommend Professor Atal Bathani, a professor at the University of Khartoum, who have recently published two books in Arabic, but they're getting translated, as far as I'm aware, to English, about the history of failed transitions in Sudan, and why, you know, each transition keep all transitions have not learned from each other and they keep on failing. And I think that would, you know, serve as a good introduction to what's happening now in Sudan.
Thank you so much to both of you for kind of allowing us for framing the conversation that we're going to have today. Maybe we can put some of your recommendations in the kind of notes online for people to access later on. I want to kind of shift to the situation on the ground at the moment. So maybe, Hamid, we can start with you. If you could tell us a little bit about what the situation is like on the ground in Khartoum, but also in other parts of the country, different towns and areas of Darfur, Kordofan, Blue Nile State, as well as the border region of Abyei. Thank you.
So I'm more informed on the situation in Khartoum for two reasons. A, because most of my network is there, but also because telecom networks are still kind of working, you know, not well, but to an acceptable you know, level in Khartoum. In other places, particularly in Darfur, most areas have been completely cut out of coverage. There is almost no way to get information out of there. And that only shows you that, you know, how bad the situation is there. But speaking about Khartoum, the situation is definitely horrific. It's getting worse every day. People who are caught in the crossfire are enduring inhumane circumstances with almost no access to healthcare. Food supplies are running low. Power and water are cut in so many areas. And most neighborhoods in Khartoum state are controlled by the rapid support forces who continue to terrorize citizens and break into their homes and you know, lose their houses and take their belongings and away and so on, but also just kill people for no good reasons at all. And obviously, on the other hand, the military is, you know, shelling neighborhoods where citizens are still residing and so on to kind of chase the rapid support forces away. So between the RSF's looting and human rights abuses and the Sudanese armed forces indiscriminate shelling, no one in Khartoum is safe at all. indescribable from the little, you know, amount of information that we're receiving because of the communication difficulties and so on. But the level of violence has reached very, you know, scary levels. People on the ground have been describing what's happening as ethnic cleansing. And I don't think they use that term lightly. So the atrocities are completely unimaginable. Other areas, you know, have been seeing fighting as well. Recently in South Kordofan, the rebel group of SPLM North of Abdelaziz Hilo have expanded their territory and took over some areas that were previously controlled by SAF, Sudanese Armed Forces. And in response, the armed forces have launched airstrikes on different villages there, and a lot of civilians were killed as a result. Many other cities continue to see fighting, but it's mostly intensified in Khartoum and in Darfur. West Darfur, particularly Jenina, is witnessing the most devastating crisis. Southerns have fled to Chad, but Al Jenina city, the capital of West Darfur, some sources there have, you know, said it's completely empty. There is no single soul in Jenina because of the mass, you know, killings and burnings that were taking place.
Thank you for giving us that overview. Radia, I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit about what the role of academics and sort of scholarly work is in providing an alternative narrative to the current kind of essentialist narrative version that we might read about, as you put it, in the news.
Thank you for that really important question, Nasreen. Those who are following Sudan now and who've been following it for the last 20 years since Darfur took off, the war in Darfur took off, there's a particular narrative around reporting Sudan's failure. It's not an individual approach to reporting on African crises in general. So there's a particular language that's used, and it's self-enforcing and reaffirming certain tropes around, you know, the post-colonial and colonial history of the continent at large. And it kind of centers narratives of ethnicity and connects them, ethnicity, corruption, patronage, patrimonialism, you know, big men. And they connect them, and it is connected to how failure happens at every junction. And at some point, you feel or almost know that, you know, these tropes have become in themselves, you know, self-sustaining narratives without any, rhyme or reason. You know, they exist outside any discourse or any framework, and they fit every juncture, every period, every crisis, and. I mean, obviously, they don't exist in a vacuum. They are a product of a long history of it's a colonial legacy of Africa in the, you know, in the global imaginary. And I believe that a lot of work needs to be done in order to kind of, you know, push a shift towards starting to think about Africa in a different way. Or what happens, what transpires on the continent in a different way. Academics should be at the helm of that. I mean, obviously, academics, researchers, scholarly activists, anyone who is involved in the process of producing text on, you know, on the African continent, as it relates to the African continent, has a duty of obviously critiquing these narratives where they're seen, whether they were overt or covert, but also to, you know, contribute collectively to the creation of, you know, alternative frameworks that give, you know, these crises the justice that they deserve. I mean, it seems like, you know, a problem of representation of how Africa is represented, you know, in the mainstream, you know, in the mainstream discourse. But it's actually much more kind of sinister and vicious. I mean, as we're speaking now, as these issues are developing in Sudan, we see on social media, just as, you know, a clear and close example, how certain, you know, individuals or certain groups, you know, present themselves, masquerade as experts. It is very easy to become, you know, an expert on Africa. All you need to do is just, you know, profess an opinion. And because of the hierarchy of knowledge, knowledge politics and knowledge production, it's very easy for you to look a certain way, to speak a certain language, to invoke certain terms, and for you to amass a following that makes you then into an expert. And from then on, the process of whatever, you know, what that person or that individual or that, you know, that platform professed, is only a skip and a hop for it then to become established discourse or narrative in a paper or, you know, in some sort of coverage that has, you know, a political and intellectual weight. So this issue around how, you know, Sudan is being kind of theorized and spoken about and analyzed in, you know, in public discourse is a continuation of an existing problem, but one that has, you know, long-term consequences. Since in today's technocratic world that we live in, it's these, you know, kind of assumed analyses or, you know, knowledge of what's happening in X place that then kind of, you know, become the basis for policy prescriptions. The problem is that the people who then kind of, you know, pass on these policies and back them up with politics and funding are not accountable to the local people who receive these prescriptions if they fail. And I have to say that there is a lot of work, you know, underway to kind of, you know, challenge these problematic epistemologies. But they are a long way from becoming, you know, central to, you know, whatever processes we kind of assume to push back. Yeah,
thank you for that. I mean, one of the things that comes to mind here is that we might want to add to the reading list that we started before, in terms of pointing people to historians, Sudanese historians who have written about some of the issues that you just discussed. So we could maybe add that to the list. We're going to kind of shift a little bit and talk again about the current situation on the ground. The UN currently estimates that over 3 billion in humanitarian aid is needed to address people's current needs inside Sudan. And so far, less than half of that has been pledged by donor countries, and very few international aid agencies are operating in the areas that are hardest hit by the fighting. Civilian volunteer networks and emergency rooms organized by resistance committees, doctors and farmers unions have from the very beginning of the war filled this kind of gap or vacuum, providing life-saving food aid, medical relief, safe passage, et cetera. And I wanted to start with you, Hamid, if you could tell us a little bit more about the role civilian volunteer actors are playing on the ground at the moment, how they organize and sustain themselves, and what that looks like outside of Khartoum as well. Thank you.
Sure. So I can speak to that you know, from my experience in Khartoum, being there for the first month of the war and so on, and also what I have been seeing online after I left Khartoum, but also what's happening in other states as well. So basically, the only channel of support that people have been receiving, you know, any sort of aid through was these informal civilian local initiatives like the resistance committees, but also other groups that were established during the war. So most of neighborhoods or localities have established these emergency rooms to coordinate their efforts and their you know, humanitarian assistance provided to citizens and so on. So they were doing a lot of great things, like coordinating safe routes for evacuation for those who want to leave their neighborhoods and go to safer areas or to leave Khartoum and so on. Ironically, they even facilitated evacuation for some of the diplomats and the international staff of international organizations and so on. But you know, the same people who facilitated these safe routes were left behind with no support whatsoever. They've also been providing food and water as well to families that, you know, have children or elderly and are unable to go out through the risky kind of journeys to get food or water and so on. They've also been trying to secure neighborhoods. So in many neighborhoods, they established barricades around the neighborhoods to kind of slow down the movement of forces, particularly from the rapid support forces, to get into the neighborhoods and so on, providing medical support. So when I was still in Khartoum, my neighborhood committee had established a network of physicians from our locality who were available to provide online support, but also to visit people at their houses when they needed. So my sister is a doctor, and you know, we spent a good time of the day driving her around from one house to another where people were calling her to come and support them. So that system, you know, was established during the war, and it's just, you know, something to admire how, meanwhile, people are going through these very difficult circumstances, they were able to establish such kind of systems to support those who are caught in the crossfire in Khartoum and in other cities. In other states, in addition to supporting the residents of the states and so on, there have been also a lot of groups that are supporting IDPs, internally displaced people coming from Khartoum and fleeing to safer states and so on. They've prepared shelters, medical support, housing, and all sorts of support for those IDPs coming from Khartoum and so on. And it's evident that these local initiatives have been able to reach to the most vulnerable citizens and those who need support the most, unlike most of the other international organizations who have been providing very limited humanitarian assistance, but that has not been reaching those who need it the most. And despite that reality, you know, the agenda of localization have not been kind of a priority for the international organizations who are providing aid in Sudan at the moment. They have not used, used is not the right word. They have not coordinated their efforts with these local initiatives to make sure that aid is reaching those who need it, and humanitarian assistance is actually assisting those who are caught in the crossfire. So this is one of the, you know, biggest gaps that we're seeing currently, and that are kind of exacerbating the impact of the war on citizens caught in the crossfire.
If you're enjoying the Haymarket Live series, you'll also be interested in a new book from Haymarket, Ireland, Colonialism, and the Unfinished Revolution by Robbie McVeigh and Bill Ralston. In this groundbreaking examination of the colonial legacy and future of Ireland, McVeigh and Ralston convincingly show that understanding Ireland's experience must be central to grasping the history of colonization and anti-colonial politics throughout the world. Part history, part analysis, this book compellingly charts the centuries of Irish colonial history and explores possibilities for the completion of the decolonization project today. As Barbara Ransby puts it, this book brilliantly analyzes the history and legacy of colonialism and resistance in Ireland and beyond. In this moment where the whole planet is in flux, this powerful account offers indispensable insights for us all. Find Ireland, Colonialism, and the Unfinished Revolution at haymarketbooks.org.
Thank you. I don't know, Raja, if you'd like to add anything to that.
Thank you, Hamid, for this kind of extensive overview. In addition to the mapping that Hamid provided, I wanted to kind of look at the larger picture, maybe the politics of volunteering, and just maybe add a few notes on that. I think it's important that for us, as a political movement, to think of volunteering in humanitarian intervention, even if driven by local expertise and resources, to kind of try and think of it not just as an act of giving, but to kind of put it in the larger context of, the sector, the nonprofit sector that it is, right? One that is politicized and influenced by political outcomes at the state level. I mean, this is the world that we're living in today, the third sector or, the humanitarian sector, the charity sector is perhaps, maybe the if not the second, the largest sector, at least at the level in Sudan. In that sense, then, we should also kind of, realize that it's prone to capture, just as the private sector is, and that, people working in the charity sector and working as volunteers have the propensity to develop social and political capital that then can be used for positive or negative ends. At the heart of this unpacking lays a bigger and an extended political concern, one that has continuities with governance and state politics, particularly the influence of political Islam in shaping political identities, right? I mean, this practice of, people volunteering to help each other is not, completely divorced from their own social practices. It is kind of, modeled around and driven by, religious edicts that people practice on a daily level. On a daily basis. So whereas some communities volunteering the particular type of volunteering might be shaped by the edicts of religion, let's say that in the standard sense, if we're thinking about zakat as a form of giving, right, as a source of, where wealth, or kind of resources are coming from to be distributed, or if it was just altruism. Now, in the case of zakat, the logic is that people are obligated to share a fraction of the profits, right? You've got a merchant, he has to give like X amount of his profits, and that's the proper religious practice. However, they're not obligated to share the source. The source of, the wealth is protected. Now, this kind of thinking is antithetical to distributive politics, under, a new kind of movement or a new kind of, political revolution. It also has its essence, this practice of, giving from the profit, but, protecting the source has its essence or its history in the culture of merchant class. And this is something that people need to kind of, you know, both learn the history of it and then unlearn the practice. And in the case of altruism, at least the way that it's kind of applied in Sudan, it seems to facilitate a discourse that blunts, you know, the roles and responsibilities kind of, you know, discourse as part of a larger social contract. And this is not conducive to democracy. So we need to be very kind of, you know, sensitized to the fact that while volunteering is very important and kind of, you know, an essential tool to saving lives and protecting, you know, people within the community and to providing a source of otherwise, you know, absent life-saving you know, materials, we also need to think, you know, as a political movement, or what drives this process of, you know, volunteerism and, you know, humanitarian response. And nothing, not even giving should be taken at face value. And I just want to also highlight that the current juncture that we're in represents additional challenges for participatory humanitarianism. And as the war takes on an ethnic tone and divisions are drawn along ideological lines, provisions will be set in the service of certain camps, certain groups. For all these reasons, the resisting committees and members of the public who are involved in these activities need to be sensitized to, you know, the politics around, you know, around volunteerism, around, you know, redistribution. And so basically, you know, this act of giving, this act of volunteering needs to be kind of, you know, connected in a very active way to the revolution's values.
Yeah, thank you so much for those important points, Raja. In most seminars on Sudan, the focus has been on understanding the generals who are struggling for power, or other political elites and international players. And of course, we will be talking about them. But it's, you know, it's primarily diaspora or foreign experts who are asked what the way forward looks like. And as I said, while we'll be talking about external actors today, I wanted to give you all an opportunity to elaborate a bit more on non-elites as political actors, who they are, what we can learn from them, as we kind of imagine a way out of this war. And I know that's a very big question, but, you know, whichever part of that you want to tackle, feel free to.
Okay, I can have a go at the question. So I think this is what we all should be looking at. We should all be studying this, analyzing it, amplifying it. Because, and mostly because Sudan's crisis to a large degree is a product of this deliberate overlooking of alternative political imaginaries and the processes that they've, you know, created. In this regard, the revolution with all its groups, projects and processes that it espoused, as well as in their evolution, provide a rich source to draw information as well as lessons learned for the failure of the transition. Now, these include, but are not limited to, as Hamid mentioned, the resisting committees, the institutional bodies that they created, like the coordination, Tansiqiyya, the coordination bodies, the frameworks, you know, that they devised in order to kind of, you know, facilitate communication, activities, you know, power sharing between themselves. And all of this was done in the service of developing an alternative and more just polity. Now, the literature that they produced in the period leading to the production of, you know, the charters, which were produced in 2022, a year after the, it was less than a year after the coup happened. So the production of the charters, but also the process of consolidating them. So not just talking about content, we're also talking about process. Speaks to, you know, a new way of doing politics that kind of, you know, is in many ways kind of, you know, a testament to how resilient, you know, these non-political elites are in, you know, first devising an idea and then seeing it through, delivering, you know, a product that is, you know, inclusive of, you know, entire communities. I have this favorite quote from the Revolutionary Charter of the People. And I'll just say it very briefly here, I'm paraphrasing. And we also have to always remember that, you know, the charters are not the product of a few kind of, you know, public intellectuals. It is produced by, you know, masses and masses and masses of people. So quotes like this kind of really capture one's attention. That the opening page of the charter says that the aim of developing this charter is a political one. The process of developing and writing the charter is a political one. That it aims to give political voice to political choice. So kind of reinforcing at every juncture that this is a political act is obviously a direct response to, you know, the elite's technocratic approach of doing politics. It is, you know, a response, a reaction to governance by technocracy, which obviously failed to deliver Sudan into a transition. Now, again, I see the charters as a way of, you know, exploring Sudan's non-elite politics. And if one is to look at them closely and examine them, then you would see within them that they are the movement's modus operandi and its political canon. And that they actually should be seen as the entry point for all Sudanese and non-Sudanese experts in kind of, you know, provide in you know, contributing to an overhaul of engagement with Sudan on every front. I think that for forthcoming Africanists, particularly political scientists, political economists, anthropologists working in Sudan, especially in the area of state building and peacemaking, it would be, you know, a crime to not look at this, you know, popular, non-elitist political project and process that is, you know, the outcome of almost a decade of, if not more, of, you know, alternative political processes, imaginaries, and so on and so forth. So again, we have this tendency in Sudan that we tend to think of things in binaries. If we're not thinking of, if we want to find another source other than, you know, armed actors or political elites, we tend to just, you know, shift to civil society without kind of, you know, considering the continuities between, let's say, traditional civil society in Sudan and the state itself. What I'm proposing here, that in order to kind of, you know, imagine a completely different non-elitist Sudanese political project, we should try and do this through, you know, the body of work that the revolution has, you know, given us over the last 4 or 5 years. So that's my approach to non-elitist politics. By kind of, you know, decentralizing the focus by kind of, you know, avoiding to look at, you know, one source that is considered the authority, even if, you know, non-state or non-armed. And yeah.
Thank you, Radia. Hamid, would you like to add anything, or do you want us to? Okay.
Yeah, just. One, two quick points. I think in addition to you know, the groups that the resistance committees that Raja spoke about and the charters that they produced, and building that, I think when we engage actors in political processes in Sudan, I think it's important to look at what have they offer, what have they produced, what are they offering, what are they bringing to the table. And the charters, for instance, is something that is important to be considered. In addition, I think there are groups, including resistance committees, but also a couple of trade unions and so on, who managed to conduct democratic elections in a post-coup environment, a very harsh and difficult environment. That is to be admired, but also to be respected and to be, given the way that it should give. In the same way that, was mentioned earlier about how, rebel groups or militias or even militaries and so on in Sudan continue to get rewarded for violence. I think it's about time to stop that and reward political actors who are offering real and genuine and, inclusive political solutions to Sudan's issues. One last thing, I think, in terms of the engagement of political actors in Sudan by the international community, ever since the revolution in 2018-2019, the international community who was facilitating the political processes in Sudan continued to warn resistance committees and other movements and social resistance groups in Sudan and so on, that their radical change agenda are going to drive Sudan into conflict. And in the contrary, it is the, ignoring these very radical change agenda is what, brought us here in the first place to the conflict itself. So I think, it's a little too late, but obviously still an opportunity for the international community to reflect on that and to admit to the mistakes that they made and to do better global powers in the future in Sudan in other relevant contexts.
Thank you. Before we move on, I actually just wanted to add that I think to both of what you were saying, that part of, I think, what happens when sort of non-elites are not considered as political actors is that you have groups like, for example, a farmers union in the Jazeera that I've worked with in the past, who have issued various statements in also very kind of popular democratic ways around land justice and the sort of need for land reform and the ways that sort of neoliberal policies before the revolution and during this transitional period really sort of decimated the agricultural sector. But because those actors were not considered sort of legitimate political actors, there were all these conversations happening that did not then center land as a central kind of key issue to be looking at. So I just wanted to mention that. I think let's move on to kind of external actors, and we don't have that much time, so maybe we'll go over it fairly quickly. Many other seminars have talked about external actors, so you can look online to those. But I wanted to start first with regional actors like Chad, Egypt, Libya, Ethiopia, and other IGAD members, but also other Sahelian states. And again, you don't have to, talk about all of them. That would take a whole seminar. But whichever one you'd like to talk about, what role are they playing in relation to the war, and in particular in response to the thousands of refugees that are fleeing Sudan and the sort of borders and what's happening there? So if you could briefly, maybe in a few minutes, just touch on that, either whoever wants to start. Thank you.
Do you want to go or should I?
Go ahead, Hamid, please. Go ahead.
So just very, very, very briefly, I think the response of regional actors, each of the countries that, you mentioned have had different responses depending on their interests in Sudan and so on. But in general, most of the responses have been conflicted and inadequate. And in some of the cases that were mentioned, quite biased towards one actor in favor of the other and so on, which kind of, you know, makes them not the best mediator, if you like. But I think in terms of the response to the displacement issue of Sudanese fleeing the war and you know, seeking refuge in these countries, South Sudan and Chad have been quite, I think, you know, supportive, have opened the borders, have shown a lot of solidarity and support, despite their drastically limited resources. Other countries in the region, neighboring countries, some, you know, it was, I think, the main issue that characterizes the response was confusion. Sometimes the borders are closed, sometimes they are allowing people, sometimes they are not allowing people, which created humanitarian crises at these borders, Egyptian borders and Ethiopian borders, namely. So at the moment, Ethiopia is allowing Sudanese to get in easily. In the beginning, that was not the case. Egyptian authorities have continued to maintain the same old policies for a few weeks, then changed the policies and made it even more difficult for Sudanese to enter Egypt. So I think overall, the response to Sudanese fleeing war has not been great. It has been inhumane in most cases. But I think that's also not the issue of neighboring countries on their own. I think the African Union, IGAD, and United Nations migration agencies and so on had an important role to facilitate safe and free and dignified routes for Sudanese to, you know, be able to relocate and to flee the war, basically. But they have not stepped up to do that role yet.
Just to add a few more points to what Hamid said. I mean, like you, Nisreen, I'm tired of this question, you know, about the role of, you know, international actors and what's happening in Sudan. And then it's either it's either their role in driving the crisis or their role in, you know, delivering a solution. And it's quite funny because it's both, you know, it's contradictory at the same time that it is, you know, unconceivable. So I think the way that this question is posed is, you know, is quite problematic in itself. I mean, I think it would serve us and the larger discourse and the narrative better if the questions were kind of, you know, reworked to kind of highlight, you know, interstate politics and, you know, the agency that, you know, some regions or maybe some countries that are further down, you know, the political hierarchy have vis-a-vis the global system. So, I mean, the way that I would think of it, and I'm not going to try and answer it because, like you said, it's been like answered, you know, hundreds of times in, you know, different outlets. And it is the center of the conversation. But maybe thinking about it a different way, if the US and the EU, when it comes to Africa, they've got a joint agenda of human security. It manifests itself in different ways, but it is ultimately human security. So human security drives, you know, control, border control, external and internal. Most probably, you know, both envisaged and implemented through, you know, excessive militarization. And then you have to think about, you have no other way but, you know, to think about then the role of, you know, the Gulf region as, you know, contributors to this kind of, you know, security arena, this, you know, global but regionalized security logic. But in their case, it's because they've got other aims. You know, their concern is mostly about consolidating their own financial control in the region so they can, you know, achieve political and economic ascendancy and global power. And then when it comes to Russia, maybe the question is, especially after what happened with Wagner a few weeks ago, is what can Sudan, you know, what can the experiences of Sudan, which is further down the line, you know, in terms of its militarization crises, teach, you know, the world, but also what can it tell us about, you know, what's happening in Russia. So trying to kind of, you know, play around differently with the component of this ever-present question in a way that kind of highlights the agency of some groups vis-a-vis others, which is a very fluid dynamic, might be much easier. And then just to reflect on, you know, these new actors that have entered the equation, that's very interesting. And my only concern is that we will now find ourselves in a similar situation where the narrative around new emerging players, regional players, and the role of the Sahel, which is already an existing, you know, problematic narrative, would, you know, kind of develop as along the same lines that kind of, you know, portrays international relations, you know, or international politics in this very kind of narrow way. When it comes to Sahel politics, the one thing I would like to say that has, you know, direct bearing on what's going on in Sudan is that what we're seeing is the weakening of the national, you know, the national logic, or the nation's logic, sorry. So now even within Sudan, you know, people affected by the war in Sudan are seeing Darfur and certain Darfur groups, especially those who are involved, who are the rank and the file of the RSF, of the militia, they're seeing them not as Sudanese, but as an extension, you know, of Sahel communities. And as a result, they see them as, you know, as external political identities, ones that have, you know, encouraged on not just on, you know, on Sudanese soil, on Sudanese you know, on the country, but also on Sudanese politics. And this has grave implications, you know, for social cohesion and political stability moving forward. Yeah, I'm just gonna leave it there.
Yeah, thank you for that. And I should say that these questions about the role of regional international actors is one that other people have been wanting to hear about. And so perhaps, I just wanted to say that. I appreciate your point about it being framed in a problematic way. But I think it's also something that, you know, audiences in North America are sort of wanting to hear more about. So on that, I guess let's briefly maybe touch on the other international actors, the US, EU, the Gulf states, and Russia. Again, this was asked by people who are attending. So whatever you want to add to that, I think, Raja, you already kind of touched on it. Hamid, if you want to talk a little bit about that, that would be great.
I think I can talk about that in link with the initiatives that, you know, we have seen so far, and mediation initiatives and peace talks that we've seen so far, because it kind of shows the role of some of these actors, but also kind of shows the problems with the approaches and the way they're dealing with Sudan. So we have seen a lot of competition and fragmentation between different actors, between you know, Western governments, governments in the region, in Africa, between institutions, the UN, the African Union, and the IGAD. And that has not been helpful at all. And that kind of actually, you know, allowed the warring generals, you know, gave them excuses to play manipulation games between different actors, play them against each other, show unwillingness to engage in one process or mediation initiative and go to the other and so on, or for kind of manipulation games and so on. And that situation is basically created by the fragmentation and the competition between these different actors. So the main initiative that, you know, has kicked off but now suspended, the Jeddah platform, the US Saudi initiative, you know, everything about it is wrong, basically. It's a flawed and repeated strategy that is exclusive, that, you know, excludes civilian voices. It's conducted with no transparency at all. No one knows what's being discussed in there. No one knows what are the agenda. And so on. But it also repeats a mistake that kept on, you know, happening over and over again, which is legitimizing these generals who are fighting at the moment. So obviously it was doomed to fail, and that happened. None of the ceasefires that it announced were honored. And so on, but it was also very Khartoum-centric. So every time a ceasefire was announced, the monitoring and the, you know, discourse was all about Khartoum, completely ignoring the fact that, you know, the war was waging in Darfur with no pause at all. Meanwhile, we have seen a few pauses in Khartoum, not cessation of hostilities, but just, you know, posing and fighting and so on, which was also used by the warring factions as opportunities to resupply and to re-strategize and so on, and for rapid support forces to use that as an opportunity, you know, a break from fighting, to go about other neighborhoods and loot more houses and abuse more civilians and so on, because of the gap in monitoring how these ceasefires are implemented. That is suspended now, but there are other initiatives being discussed, the IGAD initiative, for instance, but that is, in my opinion, rendered toothless, because none of the IGAD countries possess any leverage over the warring factions. So why would they care or listen to them? And it's currently struggling because the military are against the leadership of the President Ruto, President of Kenya, and they accuse him of being biased to RSF and so on. Then there is the African Union, who are proposing an expanded mechanism and a roadmap. And I think I have more hopes on that one rather than the other ones, but I think it still needs a lot of work for it to be functioning properly. Inclusion of civilian voices, and by inclusion of civilian voices, not the, you know, same old ways of including elites and so on. No, this needs to change. Otherwise, we are going to get the same results that we have been getting ever since the revolution and so on. But also making sure that the powers engaged in the process, international and regional, are, you know, for the process to include them in a way that, in a way, what's the word, neutralizes their interests, because there are different interests and so on, different actors supporting different warring factions, but different actors also possessing specific leverages that they could lend to these processes. So using that in a smart way is also quite important. But so far we have not seen any signs of that, particularly in terms of, you know, meaningful inclusion of civilian voices. We haven't seen any signs of that yet.
Yeah, thank you for that. I think I just wanted to add, I mean, this is, I'm not an expert on Sudanese politics, but I research Saudi and Emirati investments in land in Central Sudan. And, you know, they're not obviously a new actor. They've been investing in Sudan since the 1970s, really, since the twin oil crises. But what happened, I think, in the sort of early 2000s is that we really saw the kind of restructuring of the agricultural sector, as I mentioned, with sort of the withdrawal of state subsidies for farmers and a kind of disintegration of the kinds of inputs that farmers, especially in Central Sudan around the Jazeera scheme, needed to be able to keep it going, if you will. Many farmers fell into debt, were then forced to sell to the state. In other parts of the region, people's land was seized by the state to then attract foreign investments. And so to date, we see that, you know, Saudi and Emirati investors lease, I don't want to say own because it's mostly leases, more Sudanese land than all of Sudan's domestic investors combined. And we're looking at about, I think, 5 million acres of land, very fertile land near the Nile or over the sort of key aquifers. And they've invested, the two actors together, about $27 billion in real estate, in land, and other kinds of infrastructure projects, including one of the more recent proposals was a $6 billion port project along the Red Sea. The UAE partnered with a local business tycoon to kind of, you know, essentially create this private port that would connect to one of their farm projects and through a private toll road, et cetera. And I mentioned this more to say that, you know, there's a political economy of war that is important to understand, that has long roots, you know, that we can also take all the way back to colonial times, if you will, if you look at the legal framework that facilitates these kinds of resource grabs. And while, you know, I don't necessarily want to make a linear connection to say that, you know, the Emirates and the Saudis are major actors for those particular reasons, but they obviously, that's part of what is at stake for them. And they're on the one hand, you know, fueling the war by supporting the different factions of the war. On the other hand, they're donating food aid. So I've always felt like those two actors in particular, the Saudis and the Emiratis, have played a very sort of detrimental role for a long time, and that we should be looking more closely at what they're doing, even in our own analysis as academics. And so, yeah, let's move on then to this question of international. You already touched on this, but if you wanted to talk a little bit more about why international efforts to broker peace in Sudan have failed so far. In particular, I'd be curious to hear from you about some of these efforts to get civilian groups together. You know, there's conversations that have been happening, coalitions that have been forming. I just heard somebody, you know, talk about how even there's a way in which the resistance committees get fetishized but not necessarily taken seriously as political actors in terms of co-creating what that process might look like. I don't know if this is making sense to you, but I'd love to hear your thoughts on that. Yeah.
Yeah, I think just to add briefly, so all the initiatives that we have been hearing about, but not only post-war, but ever since the revolution took place, and everything that they say about, you know, the revolution's aspirations and including the movements that have made the revolution possible and so on, all of that has been lip service. There haven't been any, you know, meaningful mechanisms and processes to include these voices in any way. And I think, you know, now the post-war context would be used as an excuse, I fear, to continue excluding them. Most of them are still in Khartoum or in other states in around Sudan and so on. So it's difficult to include them in the conversation. Those who are in Egypt are unable to leave Egypt, so it's difficult to bring them to wherever those who are. So, you know, making all of these logistical excuses as a way to get around that inclusion of the voices that should be heard and so on, I feel this will happen all over again. We have been hearing about different attempts at forming coalitions and so on, but it's still done in a very ad hoc way that is not necessarily, you know, it does not allow those on ground or those who need to be included to get included. This would require a lot of innovation and so on. But it will also, I think, the first step to start with is to listen to these people. It does not, you don't have, they don't have to be in the room. Resistance committees, other civilian groups on ground in Sudan have been publishing their demands, have been publishing their opinions on social media and so on. And, you know, the international community and diplomats often, you know, would receive these documents and say, yes, very interesting, and then not do anything about it. So I think listening to these people and taking the agenda that is, you know, is not very easy to find, taking it on board is quite important. But yeah, I honestly do not see any signs of that changing, despite the current situation is a result of repeated mistakes, flawed strategies in dealing with Sudan, and you know, despite so many diplomats admitting that as individuals, we have not seen any change in policy from these respective countries or institutions.
Raja, would you like to add something?
Just a very small point about who gets to play peace actor. I mean, to be honest, I, from what I've seen, what I've heard, you know, so far, there's a problem with the peace kind of, you know, model itself. That, like you said earlier, Nisreen, it's kind of there's a historical continuity to it that goes back to maybe colonial times and colonial legal framings. That even now, for example, when people are thinking of Darfur or even North Kordofan or, you know, South Kordofan, with all these kind of, you know, skirmishes and tensions happening, people immediately, you know, think of customary authority as, you know, legal actors, as the ones who should step in, you know, and try and kind of diffuse tension. So what essentially is happening is that you've got a situation where people are dealing with the manifestations of violence, right, through mediation, rather than trying to deal with the root causes of it, which is what, in my opinion, the resisting committees have been trying to do for years now. So when, you know, a resisting committee in a particular place sets up an event to talk about food security, that is essentially, you know, a step towards, you know, ensuring lasting peace, but on different terms. So I would, when it comes to, you know, when it comes to peacemaking, I would say that the overall model, right, the discourse itself, the way that the state goes about kind of, you know, manipulating it for, you know, for the purpose of capture, is one that needs to kind of be dismantled before we talk about peace in any meaningful way. We're gonna stop here because I realize we've got a lot to cover.
Go ahead, Hamid.
Yeah, sorry, I know we're running late, but just in 30 seconds, I think one of the main issues that we are also seeing now is how the initiatives by international organizations or countries and so on have continued to dismiss and to ignore local initiatives. We have seen ever since the war started, I think around 4 or 5 local peace peacemaking initiatives in Darfur, in Al-Fashir, in Al-Jinena, in Zarinje, in Al-Dayn, and in some of these places, particularly, for instance, Al-Dayn and Al-Fashir, they have, you know, succeeded in you know, bringing some peace to these places, more than whatever the platform brought to Khartoum or to anywhere. And ignoring these initiatives and not supporting them and not, you know, giving them premium seats at the table and making sure that we learn from what they did and how they did it, just because it's, you know, unconventional for the international community to deal with such initiatives and so on, is a mistake that we, you know, will pay back for it if we don't correct that as we move forward.
Great, thank you so much. So we're going to wrap up. I'm going to ask one last question, and then maybe at the very end, we could briefly talk about the ways people could maybe plug in if they wanted to do, they wanted to support the work that you all are doing or are involved in. So this is from the audience. How do you all see the possibility of an end to the war and a return to the revolution? I know, also a very big question for the last 2 minutes here.
Well, just very quickly, by enabling, you know, localized political processes, by enabling local actors who have a stake in peace, but also more importantly, who have the ability and the resources to kind of, you know, devise a process and implement it that brings about the end of war and, you know, instigate, you know, a longer term process of ensuring the continuity of this peace. Because whatever kind of firefighting approach that the international community has, you know, historically favored at the state, at the level of the state, as Hamid has already said, we've seen once and time again that they're short-lived and their cost is very high. So I think it's about time that, you know, local actors are, you know, enabled to take this forward. Thanks.
Okay, great. Thank you so much. I think that's a great sort of point to end on, unless Hamid, you wanted to add anything? Okay. So maybe we could just end, if you all wanted to talk about an initiative that you're involved in that people can plug into. I will maybe start and just say that I'm at the University of Toronto, and we have a Sudanese, we have a relatively large Sudanese student population. And so we have a collective of graduate and undergraduate students who are doing different kinds of work. But we're trying to establish a fund the work has been ongoing, but they raised some money for the Sudan Doctors Union. We're now trying to establish a solidarity fund that would continue to raise money for primarily independent unions and volunteer efforts that are led by resistance committees and other sort of actors that, as Raja mentioned earlier, are sort of, how do I put this? That were sort of the backbone of the revolution, but very much sidelined during the transitional process. I just want to encourage you all, if you feel moved to support that, we will advertise it when it's, we're just trying to figure out the bureaucratic parts of it. But that's kind of one thing that I wanted to highlight and ask you to look out for. Thank you. I don't know, Raja or Hamid, if you wanted to add anything else that you feel like people should plug into one more thing I wanted to say is that I'm not like a huge, there are advocacy efforts happening. For me, I think the most important thing, honestly, that we can do is to pressure our own governments in the UK and the US and Canada to change their immigration policies vis-a-vis Sudanese. To me, I feel like that is our role more than anything. And so I wanted to also highlight the work of the Black Alliance for Just Immigration, because they've been working on these issues in tandem with other African communities around renewing in the US temporary protected status, which is probably going to happen, but also turning that into sort of paths to citizenship and other kinds of special visas, because at the moment the response has been quite horrendous, actually, in terms of really, you know, the Canadian government, I think, shut down their website and people aren't able to even apply anymore. And so I just wanted to mention that as instead of us jumping to sort of saying, you know, let's advocate for advocacy, you know, to be in the room to talk about peace negotiations or whatever. I think the role really should be more around what are the governments in the countries that we're staying in doing in terms of their immigration policies as well. Thank you. Go ahead, Roger.
I just wanted to add to that about the role of diaspora. I mean, we also need to like understand that the world has changed to a huge degree in diaspora. Sunni diaspora today isn't what it was 30 years ago. And that we're all, you know, part of a globalized system where we probably serve, you know, in our own kind of professional capacity as, you know, influential members of, you know, transnational institutions that does have a say, either directly or indirectly, on the status quo of Sudan or what happens and what transpires in Sudan. So I think just, you know, an attempt to kind of try and, you know, reflect and understand, you know, our positionalities and our role to begin with goes a long way towards, you know, developing effective advocacy mechanisms.
Thank you. Go ahead, Hamid, you have the last word.
I think the last thing that I would say is that for those following Sudan to keep on following, you know, the news from the resistance committees and other groups on ground and what are they saying and what kind of visions and political charters they're producing and so on and get, you know, advocate for that to be centered at each and every process. And I think also to just make sure that, you know, as events unfold in Sudan, it's becoming, the situation is becoming worse every day. But on the other hand, it's becoming sort of a forgotten conflict. So not allowing that to happen would also be quite important.
Thank you. So with that, I'm going to hand it back to Shireen. I just wanted to say thank you to both you, Raja and Hamid, for your insights, your analysis, and all the work that you've been doing to sort of raise our own consciousness and knowledge about Sudan over the last couple of months. Thank you also, Shireen, for all of the organizing and hard work that you're doing behind the scenes. So I'm going to hand it back to you. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Nasreen, Raja, and Hamid, for your invaluable analysis of the current moment in Sudan, and also to the others who helped plan behind the scenes, Doha El-Mardi, John, and Haymarket Books, and Spectre Journal. In these last comments, you reminded me the importance of keeping an eye on Sudan and that our fates are linked from the U.S. to Sudan to Palestine. Our liberation struggles and freedom struggles and revolutions are linked, and you can't really see them as separate. But you can find more articles on Sudan's revolution and counter-revolution on Spectre's website. And again, we encourage folks to subscribe to Spectre Journal. And also, I would recommend, of course, following the stream, Hamid and Raja, to read their analysis as the situation continues, as well as I'll just recommend a couple other names, Muzan and Neil, Megdi El-Kizuli, and Matt Nashid, among others. So see you all next time, and thanks so much.
Thanks for listening. If you like this episode, subscribe to our podcast and to the Haymarket Books YouTube channel, where events like this one are hosted live. And don't forget to check out haymarketbooks.org.